Good evening and welcome to World Press. On this show, we check newspapers throughout the world to see how they are reporting and interpreting the major news stories of the day. On tonight's program, we're going to check the press of Red China, Japan, Great Britain, France, Germany, and the Soviet Union. There's been a lot of anti-American reaction now for the past several months in Turkey. The aircraft carrier Forrestal was just there, Turkish students and citizens rioting against it. You're picking up anything about this in your press?
Well, yes. Excuse me, Paul. The French press says that as long as the United States cut their help, they had no business showing with that big fleet. And therefore, it divided the between the two parties, the right and the left were evidently manifesting, plus the students.
It's a great deal of comment in the Soviet press, and all very cheerfully presented, because the Turkish students and others are protesting, and of course the Soviet Union has vested interests in the Turkish Straits.
I think the German press sort of accepted the explanation of the Turkish government, saying that this was a very small minority that was protesting, and it would be a grave mistake for the United States to believe that the Turkish people's opinion about America has changed.
Pakistan's Field Marshal Ayub Khan, who's more or less had things under control, we've been led to believe, in that country for the past decade anyway, has now said that he will resign at the end of 13 months or let his office run out. What are you picking up on that score?
A lot in the British press, Roger. They compare him both with King Lear and President Johnson. They think that he has maintained order and given the country some stability for about 10 years, but he's failed recently really to introduce genuine democracy, apart from his version of guided democracy from the top, and that he's lost touch with the city people and the intelligentsia. They're very worried that his withdrawal will mean a return to the chaotic turbulence that preceded.
Well, it's major news in Japan every day. I'd say that they agree to the last point Leslie made. Ayub Khan may have been forced to resign, just as Lyndon Johnson had, by an intolerable situation, but they see no improvement coming out of it. That the East Pakistan, the East Bengal situation is motivated more by nationalism and opposition to the idea of Pakistan itself, that there are numerous contenders, and if Ali Bhutto comes to power, this produces Pakistan's movement toward China, which goes along with the trouble in South Asia generally, namely West Bengal, that is part of India, has just elected a pro-communist government.
Yeah.
Well, the big story in the allied world has been the growing problems between Great Britain and France caused by General de Gaulle's attitude toward Britain and the common market. In the communist world, the actions of Romania towards the Warsaw Pact countries and towards the USSR is causing great interest and, I'm sure, concern in the Soviet Union. So first we go to the Soviet press and Paul Zinner.
Thank you, Roger. Let me start with a couple of non-items in the Soviet press. The press is almost always obliging in that respect. One pertains to Ambassador Dobrynin's visit with President Nixon last week. This is how Izvestia reported it on the back pages. There are 2, 4, 5.5 lines given to that item, which we consider to be important because the Soviets supposedly told Mr. Nixon, or President Nixon, that they had no objection to his going to Berlin. The second non-item concerns Romania, and here again on the back pages of Izvestia, this brief item laconically noting that Marshal Jakubowski, the head of the Warsaw Pact forces, and a first deputy foreign minister, Vasily Kuznetsov, visited in Romania, in Bucharest. The visit supposedly was warm and cordial. The atmosphere was friendly. This visit must be seen in relation to what the Romanian press has been publishing lately. And while I avidly read that press, I seldom report it here. The Romanians have been extremely vocal again in the past few weeks in their opposition to the Brezhnev doctrine of limited sovereignty and their opposition to the efforts of the Eastern Bloc Economic Organization, Comecon, to force them into a multilateral mold. They've spoken up, out on that in newspaper articles and through their president. It seems to me that the Soviet Union is now trying to intervene again in Romania, first with talks only, to induce the Romanians to be more sensible. And this effort must be seen in relation to what has been published in the Soviet press. An article in Pravda under this headline, Lenin on the Historic Mission of the Working Class and the Party of Communists, a long theoretical article, deals with the role of the Communist Party. And while it doesn't make any references to Romania, it certainly lambastes the Maoist deviation. Another article to which our press did refer in the military paper, Krasnaya Zvezda, by a Major General Bochkarov, who is also a candidate of philosophy, a learned military man, under the title V.I. Lenin and the Defense of Socialist Achievements and International Duty. He must be referring to Romania without mentioning the country, because he says that it is not enough to pay verbal homage to international obligations by saying that every country must be sovereign, because quite clearly sovereignty can only be achieved under socialism. One must prove one's intentions by cooperation, multilateral cooperation and multilateral defense of this sovereignty against the resurgent forces of imperialism. And this clearly Romania is not doing. And then Bochkarov goes on to say that to exalt merely national sovereignty and go no further is petty bourgeois nationalism. And of course, this is one of the greatest heresies of which any communist can be guilty. If he means the Romanians, then they have, of course, been placed on the pedestal of the heretical communists for being petty bourgeois nationalists.
Paul, when Czechoslovakia talked tough to the Soviet Union, they ended up with 600,000 Russian troops in their territory. Romania must be concerned, right on the border there. What's your view from the press?
Well, from the press, I would judge that the Romanians must feel that talking tough is likely to help them by alerting world opinion in advance, and that talking soft doesn't make much sense to the Russians. If the Russians want to do something, they very likely will do it, and the Romanians are most concerned about raising the ante so high that perhaps that will deter them.
By world opinion, are you talking about Warsaw Pact world opinion or Western world opinion?
I should think world opinion in general, not Warsaw Pact world opinion. Quite clearly, the Warsaw Pact leaders cannot do anything against the Soviet command. But to alert the people in Yugoslavia, perhaps, in Albania even, and, of course, throughout the rest of the world.
Paul, the Soviet ambassador to Bonn apparently has been trying to make a deal with the German Chancellor Kiesinger, allowing West Berliners passage into East Berlin if the elections will be shifted from Berlin on March 5th. How does the Soviet press treat this situation?
I haven't got the latest, that is the last day or two on it. On the whole, the Soviet press has been restrained on the latest Berlin flap, really quite restrained.
Fred.
Paul, switching to Poland for a moment, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung has an in-depth report about apparently a change in the relationship between Gomulka and General Mozart. In the past, they were adversaries. Now, lately, it seems that Gomulka seems to be defending Mozart, which he hadn't been doing in the past. Any comment?
Well, there is nothing in the Soviet press on this. In fact, there's been very little on Polish development, so I could only offer a personal comment. I don't know whether that's wanted.
Chalmers.
I wanted to ask you a Polish question myself, but you might have found it in the East European press. It's reported in the Japanese press that there's been a major exodus of Jews from Poland, and that the Polish government, in fact, has been taxing them rather heavily in order to obtain exit permits. Now, granted, there are not too many Polish Jews left, but is there any discussion in any East European press of this?
No, this is also treated in complete silence, and one can only guess that this is an embarrassing issue.
Thank you, Paul. The big news, as I said earlier, in the Allied world is the treatment of General de Gaulle towards Great Britain and the common market, culminating in a lunch he had with the British ambassador the other day, Mr. Christopher Soames, in which he, in general, denigrated the common market and British entry into it. So next to the British press and Leslie Lipson.
Well, Roger, as the British press sees it, General de Gaulle is at it again. Official relations between London and Paris have seldom been as bad as they were last week, a week which began with an impasse and ended with an imbroglio. The impasse was over the meeting which the British had invited to London of the Western European Union, which the French government decided officially to boycott. That was a meeting which was intended to discuss the Middle East, but as you see from this cartoon in The Guardian, General de Gaulle saw it as a backdoor British move to enter the common market. This is Mr. Wilson at the back door. The British papers thought this was a fit of pique on the part of the general, that he was setting rules for the meeting and demanding that everybody else observe his version of the rules. The Daily Telegraph on Tuesday of last week had a headline, De Gaulle's spleen, and called his move a heavy-handed overreaction and a petulant fit of temper. The London Times on Thursday of last week went further and said, France attacks her friends, and said it was unthinkable that they could not get together to discuss the Middle East or any other international situation under the auspices of WEU. But by the end of the week, the press was fully involved in the dispute over a conversation which took place in Paris on February 4th between these two men. Here you see President de Gaulle with Ambassador Soames. Mr. Soames, by the way, is the son-in-law of Sir Winston Churchill. He was minister in the former Conservative government. He's a man of great experience. They'd had a conversation on February 4th at which, according to the British ambassador, General de Gaulle made proposals which were later communicated by the British government to the other countries of the common market and to Washington. This is how the Daily Telegraph reported it on Saturday. Similar headlines in The Guardian, similar attention paid to it in the London Times. According to the details presented here, President de Gaulle proposed to Ambassador Soames that the British and the French get together for preliminary talks, that these should lead to the scrapping of NATO, that they should lead to the restructuring of the common market into a loose free trade association which he would permit the British to enter. Soames reported this to London and then had a further talk on London's instructions with Monsieur Debray. About the authenticity of the conversation, both the Times and the Sunday Times state that Mr. Soames, after the luncheon, wrote down his notes of the conversation, sent these notes to the Palais Élysée, and received an initial copy back 3 days later from Monsieur Bernard Tricot, the foreign affairs advisor of President de Gaulle. As to the interpretation, the British view is that the general was setting a trap for them and they would not fall into it, because the trap would have separated Britain from its friends on the continent and from the United States. The Sunday Times had the headline with a question mark, "Perfidious France." They said de Gaulle was once again playing games. The British wouldn't play the game his way. The Guardian called it an invitation to perfidy. They said the president's imaginings are often wild as well as grand. This was certainly a wild one. And that, Roger, is how the British press last week saw the machinations of the Machiavelli of Paris.
Leslie, I appreciate that Britain and France and everyone in Europe is very upset about this. But as General de Gaulle has always been ambivalent towards the common market, even though France is in it, and as he's always felt that Great Britain was too close to the United States, in effect, what's new?
What is new is the way in which he set about doing it, as the British see it, to separate them from all their friends on the continent and from the United States, because he had even suggested that the British publicly take the initiative of requesting such conversations, which he would then graciously approve. And he was doing this all behind the back of his friends and allies.
What does this do, according to the British press, to the Nixon visit and the American relationship?
According to them, it creates extraordinary difficulties for President Nixon, because it creates public disunity, certainly between Britain and France, and Germany is involved in this at the very time when our president is going there to try and foster unity.
Leslie, on a different tack, the Red Chinese seized some yachts in the Hong Kong waters. How did the British press treat this?
Well, it's been off the front pages because other things have been very, very much more central. They expect this kind of thing with China, this kind of barbarian behavior.
Germaine.
I'm very interested in your report of the English press, Leslie, and I'm interested in the article of Henri Pierre quoting The Guardian, who said, "What benefit is it to Britain? What benefit is it to Britain to divulge to the allies of France a secret conversation?"
The point was, as the British press interprets it, and as they interpret the Foreign Office, that Britain could not enter secretly into conversations which involved treaty agreements, such as the common market and NATO, behind the backs of their other friends and allies.
But it was not. Anyway.
Paul.
Leslie, the Soviet press interprets de Gaulle's latest move somewhat differently from the British press. It expresses the opinion that de Gaulle is acting in the role of the defender of the integrity of Europe against an Anglo-U.S. takeover, and they are very pleased about it. Have the British commented on this at all?
The British haven't commented on the Soviet version. I haven't seen anything on that, though they would doubtless express pleasure at the Soviet notion of an integrity of Europe in view of how they behaved in Czechoslovakia.
Chalmers.
Yes, Leslie, the Japanese press has been very interested in this because of the criticism over the last several years of the United States for ignoring Europe. They see it as a dilemma between the United States stressing alliance politics or détente politics, that is, a direct approach to the USSR. And they conclude, in the most recent editorial I've seen, that this puts tremendous pressure on the United States to quit trying to lead, create, or unify some Kennedy-like grand design in Western Europe and to deal directly with the power its own size, the USSR. What does the British press say to this?
The British press feel very strongly that they want the British and their allies and friends on the continent to be fully associated with the United States in all negotiations for detente with the Soviet Union and within the framework of NATO. That's the official view, and it's the view of public opinion expressed in the leading papers.
Thank you, Leslie. Next, the French press with Germain Thompson.
This is the French side. I would like to emphasize that the French press, as I have reported here frequently, is certainly not a friend of de Gaulle. It is very inimical to de Gaulle. And it is very extraordinary that in this crisis, it does accuse the British without any qualms. It doesn't approve the idea of de Gaulle, of the new idea of Europe. It blames the conduct of Britain. Le Figaro, on Sunday the 22nd, has this big headline: a diplomatic tempest broke out at the eve of the arrival of Mr. Nixon in Europe. France and Great Britain confront each other on the new de Gaulle idea for a European Union. And Paris gives the lie to the so-called revelation of London. The ideas of de Gaulle are always the same and are not new at all and well known. In the same paper, we have an article by Roger Massif, who is no friend of de Gaulle. He accused him the other day of behaving very badly about the Union of Occidental Europe. And in this article, headed by the word "In Europe, a Tempest," the writer shows that the drama started at the luncheon with de Gaulle and the British ambassador, at which de Gaulle outlined loosely his idea of a larger Europe and therefore a change in NATO. The writer says also that the British changed the character of his talk with de Gaulle by not saying that de Gaulle was only exploring an idea. And de Gaulle made very clear to Mr. Soames that he wanted to explain the same ideas to Mr. Nixon when Mr. Nixon would arrive. Naturally, he asked Mr. Soames to keep those ideas rather quiet. He waited for Mr. Nixon. Figaro of Friday is interesting because in a very small framed article, there is this title: The Secret Cause for the Crisis Between Britain and France on the UEO, that is to say, the Union for Occidental Europe. That crisis, which took place last week, was unexplainable until the rumors went around the halls of that organization. And evidently, the British had talked to all the partners of France, in spite of the fact that Mr. de Gaulle had asked Mr. Soames to be rather quiet on his ideas, which were not a proposal. Le Monde is extremely interesting because it is a very harsh enemy of de Gaulle, and it comes out with a big headline: the controversy between Paris and London flames up again at the arrival of Mr. Nixon. In this article here, which I'm going to sum up, the writer says that Mr. Soames asked himself for the interview with de Gaulle. And Monsieur Tricot, the secretary of the Élysée, saw the text given by the ambassador Soames, left, however, the answers answers of Mr. Soames, and Mr. Tricot never put his okay on that report. De Gaulle asked for confidential talks, as I already said. In the editorial, it is interesting to see that the writer says there's a complete lack of confidence between the two countries. Britain did a great deal of harm to the cause of Europe. And obviously, by reading carefully the document, de Gaulle did not expect his ideas to be talked about, obviously.
Can I cut in and ask you a question, Germain? All this coverage in the press about the fact that the British ambassador spoke out of turn, or at least didn't keep a confidence. But how do they sum up now Anglo-British relations? Have they really been damaged, or is it a tempest in a teapot?
No, it is not a tempest in a teapot, because there's such lack of confidence between the two countries that things are damaged. Now, evidently, it is two ways. rather, the British said the French tricked them, and the French do not say that the British tricked them. It says that the British actually did not behave very nicely.
There's some talk, at least in our press here in the United States, that France will pull out of the common market. What's the French press say?
It doesn't say anything of the kind.
What did the French press say, if anything, about the fact that the Israeli plane got machine gunned at the Zurich airport? What was the reaction to that?
It says that the Israeli are keeping very quiet, and if they retaliated, they wouldn't have a chance in the UN, because actually the composition of the Security Council would prevent any, if they did something, they would be blamed immediately.
The French economy is going to be probably again in danger because of wage negotiations in mid-March, which were already agreed on retroactively during the crisis in May. Any comment on that? What do the French papers expect? Will the wage settlements be inflationary, a danger to the franc?
You know, it's very interesting, Fred, because the news are very good. Both in the Le Monde and the L'Express were not, as I say, friendly to the goal, even less than the Figaro. It says that the raise of prices have been 3% and that the wages have gone only, have really kept their advantage of 15%, and therefore there's a good chance for the French to make it. Now, needless to say, the CGT, the Communist Union, is going to come out and ask for escalation, escalation of prices and so on, but there's a very good chance for the French to make it.
Leslie.
Germaine, your report agreed with mine on one point, the regrettable fact that official relations between London and Paris are now deplorably bad. But the British press go further. They say that Gaullist diplomacy has isolated France, though there are only two capitals with which at the moment Paris is close and cordial, namely Madrid and Cairo. Does the French press comment on the isolation of France?
Absolutely. Now, if I'd had time, if darling Roger here had given more time, I would have gone on with this, but I didn't get it. Therefore, I want to tell you, it's very interesting that the French, Monsieur de Brême made very clear, followed the Castilla plan, that is to say, to keep the sort of friendly all the countries on the Mediterranean border, and to evidently put them, drive them together for interest of oil. This is the back of the Arab policy. Now, if you want to talk of criticism of de Gaulle, certainly the papers have criticized de Gaulle for being harsh, unyielding with his partners.
Thank you, Germaine. Our time is at your disposal.
Next, the
French press and Fred Breyer.
Well, in fact, today I'm reporting the German press.
Excuse me, Fred.
And I would just like to say that the Germans, of course, are somewhat in the middle between England and France on the recent difficulty of France is leaving the Western European Union. I think in contrast to the British, they don't, the Frankfurter Allgemeine in elite editorial says, does not say de Gaulle of France violated the Western European Union constitution, but they engage in lengthy, almost Germanic interpretations of Article 8 so that the careful reader could almost apply for a PhD in political science as to whether the rule of unanimity applied or did not apply. The Swiss, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, I think gets much more down to the point by saying, now, why did France leave the Western European Union? Certainly not because of some minor legal point, but they feel, one, that they felt that maybe England would get into the common market by the back door through the Western Union and didn't want it. Secondly, an interesting speculation that at the next meeting that the Near East situation might have come up, and that France is at substantial variance in opinion versus Arab and Israel from the other members of the Western European Union. The Spiegel has, of course, the latest issue, the gossip magazine, so needless to say that the Gaulle-Somme affair for them is really something that they would report. Substantially, I think they say that Somme should be trusted. They, however, aren't so sure that the British did right in actually in running to their common market partners and the United States. They translate on the humorous side a comment by Russell Baker, the columnist of the New York Times, who in this connection recommends to President Nixon, when you are received by President de Gaulle, keep on kneeling until the president permits you to stand up. And also during the conversation, be darn sure that you never use the word England, because otherwise things are going to be bad. On the Berlin crisis, I think there is a general sigh of relief in the German papers that I have received to date that the Russians are willing to make some kind of deal. The Frankfurter Allgemeine says we are now on the right track. Die Welt is a little more doubtful and says, should we really give up Berlin for the passage agreement to East Berlin? The Spiegel has some predictions as to what the Germans are going to ask of President Nixon at the meeting, which is to take place this week. First, they will want greater European security, the peaceful atomic energy development under the non-proliferation treaty, that the United States should press the Russians for greater latitude. They want the U.S. to keep troops in Germany, and then there will be some haggling as to how much is to be paid. The Germans would like to pay only 80% of the foreign exchange cost. And according to the Spiegel, inside information, the Germans are going to offer the United States a loan in Germany, which would be placed at a very low rate of interest, and the German government would make up the difference between the market rate of interest and the one charged to us.
You say your press in Germany is pleased that the Russians have gotten involved in the Berlin situation to try and ease things. As Herr Brandt has wanted the elections all along in Berlin, and as Chancellor Kiesinger has always wanted them in Bonn or out of Berlin, how are they going to resolve it?
First of all, I'm not so sure the German papers would agree necessarily that Herr Brandt was so keen on Berlin. In fact, last week, I think most of the German papers were blaming Herr Gerstenmaier, now out, for having insisted on Berlin. And I think that everybody would have resisted quitting Berlin under pressure. But as a matter of an agreement, now that's a different story.
Fred, the big elections, the Bundestag elections, have now been called, as I understand, for September 28th. Who does the German press and the pundits think is going to succeed? Do they think it'll be the Socialists or the CDU, or do they think the coalition will stay?
I already gave you the latest report, and you know the Gallup polls are expensive, and they haven't had another one since, at least not reported. So at the last Gallup poll about 2 weeks ago, they thought there might be a possibility of an outright CDU victory, or there might be a possibility that the SPD or the CDU could get together with the independent FDP. So the outcome is yet very uncertain.
Chalmers.
Yes, Fred, in terms of these desiderata of the German government to ask Mr. Nixon, is there any concern in the German press at all that this disarray in the European alliance might have certain effects on Mr. Nixon, Mr. Kissinger? He has, after all, been rather embarrassed by this affair. It might lead the Americans to think that it wasn't such a good idea to try and rebuild the Atlantic alliance.
Well, I don't think that has come out in the German press. They are all very, very hopeful that the Nixon visit will mean the beginning of a new chapter of closer relationship. I believe that the German papers, although they are in a way too polite to say it, at least the ones that I read, feel that Germany has been strengthened by all of this rather than weakened, that she's sort of in between Britain and France, and that everybody is now running to Bonn saying, help us, you see, with the other side.
If the common market goes up in smoke, Fred, is Germany helped or hurt?
Well, I would say nobody will be helped if the common market goes up in smoke. But I would say that the Germans have always wanted an open economy because they feel strong enough to trade with anybody in the world, regardless of tariff preferences.
Germaine.
I want to ask you regarding the common market, Fred. It is known that if England enters the common market, she cannot afford the agricultural prices. Immediately, the milk and so on would go up 25%. Besides, British is in great debt. I think she owes $2 billion. Now, how do the Germans see that, the entry of England in the common market with that kind of a load?
Well, I don't think there's been anything on that very recently, but the Germans have followed the negotiations between England and the Common Market Commission in great detail, and they felt that the British had indeed made reasonable offers on that score, and the British were willing to pay the price of higher agricultural imports for getting into the common market. So that was not the reason for their not being in it, if the German press is quoted.
Leslie.
Fred, on the subject of the WEU meeting in London, the British press last week was saying that Chancellor Kiesinger wobbled rather uncomfortably, that he sent his representative to the meeting, but he issued interpretations which tended to favor de Gaulle's position. Do the German press feel that he was taking a strong enough stand?
Well, shall I quote the gossip from the Spiegel? They say, until Friday, Herr Kiesinger was on the British side, and then he received a visit from the French ambassador in Bonn, who said, don't forget, you see, that soon after the Nixon visit, you're going to go to Paris, and better behave yourself. And apparently, Herr Kiesinger thought again. End of story.
Thank you, Fred. Before we go to our next report, I'd like to introduce a French political visitor who's back on the show for the second time, Monsieur Aymar Achille Fou. Monsieur Achille Fou, we're very happy to see you again after a couple of years' absence. Our guest is a member of the French Chamber. He was elected in 1962, re-elected in 1966, and again in 67. He's a member of the Center Party, the PDM, not a Gaullist. He's the mayor of a village in the Bordeaux region, and he makes a very fine wine called Chateau Bechevel. Wish I'd had a chance to have some. But at any rate, welcome. What about that report that France is isolated, and you're only talking to Cairo and one or two others?
Madrid.
Well,
we could give a few examples of the contrary, I believe. For instance, after the peace conference on the war, the Vietnamese war, is now taking place in Paris. For instance, I think the great powers' governments are looking at with great interest the French proposals concerning the Middle East. And after all, though we all know that General de Gaulle has some character and things are not always easy to deal with General de Gaulle, I don't suppose, though the various incidents you've just been speaking of, that France is more isolated now than it was before.
Monsieur Achille-Poul, I think really what people are interested in is the fact that the Soviet Union, having occupied Czechoslovakia and apparently scaring the daylights out of Romania and Yugoslavia, to name two others, and having a weakened NATO on its front, are wondering whether or not France will join in some sort of team play with the United States and Germany and Great Britain, or wants to go it alone with a force de frappe or whatever it is you've got. How do you react?
No, I personally don't at all think that France can imagine that alone it would be of any counterweight towards the Eastern policy. But the point is, I'm not sure that General de Gaulle thinks much of Europe having a very great links with United States altogether. I personally am not quite on the same side, as you know, as the majority ideas on the question, but the official French policy is that, on the contrary, independent Europe may be a link between the Western part and the East. And I don't at all think that General de Gaulle is trying to pull down Europe altogether. I think he has his ways to Europe, who are perhaps not exactly mine, but to exist altogether. And even that incident on the so-called proposal that de Gaulle made to Christopher Soames, the British ambassador, perhaps maybe in the future, once things have peaced down between France and Great Britain, another way of imagining Europe. There's nothing dishonorating in that, if I may say.
One more question from me, Monsieur. When you were here before, you spoke as a veteran of the Indo-Chinese fight, and you said we ought to get out of Vietnam. Now we're at the peace table, and it's going along quite slowly. What's your forecast?
I believe you remember that last year, most Americans probably weren't in agreement with the position I took at that moment, and I do believe the thing has changed since in the public eye, and that on that point I probably was right. Things will be difficult, certainly, but I do believe getting conversations around a table is some progress anyway. And I do think on the two sides there is some desire of peace, the rest being action to have conversation in the best position possible and so on. But I'm not pessimistic, personally.
You mean?
Would you tell us something about the two pronouncements of Mr. Pompidou recently, one at Rome and very recently in Geneva, showing that definitely he was a candidate to be the president, the next president of France. The paper said there was no reception of Mr. de Gaulle after his pronouncement in Rome. Are they fighting or what?
You know that the lots of people in France and in the world have said and have thought that behind de Gaulle there was no one. Now there is one. Mr. Pompidou clearly made the assessment that he would be candidate to General de Gaulle's succession. I think on principle, if I try and synthesize what I heard about the question in the couloir of the National Assembly, in principle, I'm convinced that General de Gaulle doesn't disagree with seeing Mr. Pompidou as a successor. He said so beforehand, and he didn't deny after Mr. Pompidou's statements in Rome and in Geneva. Did he think that the moment was well chosen by Mr. Pompidou to make that assessment? That, I must say, I don't know. But, as you know, what Mr. Pompidou said was of great interest for lots of people, and even for us in the center.
Leslie.
It's quite an event.
Monsieur Achillefeuille, in the future, when certain present-day ruling personalities will have changed, do you think it will be possible and to the benefit of France to play an active role in an association with its partners which will be both European and Atlantic?
Will it be of benefit of France to be a good associate in that? I'm personally certain it will be. But I'm not against independence for Europe. I believe if, for the East, Europe looks like a puppet of the United States, it's neither good for Europe, nor is it for the United States. And I could quote President Nixon about that, because it seems to me he just said when he arrived that a strong Europe with good, friendly links with the States could probably be a great element for his next conversations with the Russians.
Monsieur Achillefeuille, we very much enjoyed having you with us. Many thanks for coming, and we hope to see you soon again. Good luck on your trip in the United States.
Thank you very much. I do take an appointment for next year at the same time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Next, the press of Red China and of Japan with Chalmers Johnson.
Thank you, Roger. Evidence has been building up for some weeks now in the Chinese press that the current internal policies of the regime are to prepare the country for some major new economic and social development campaign. Presumably, the full dimensions of this campaign will be revealed at the 9th Congress of the Communist Party to be held later this year. Last Friday, the People's Daily carried a major editorial announcing that in 1969 is to be a year of economic leap, and strongly suggested this new campaign would be an improved version of the Great Leap Forward of 1958. One element in the new campaign is an almost total reliance on the thought of Mao and downgrading expertise in raising production. Here, for example, is a full page, front page of People's Daily, given over to examples of how Mao's thought may be used. Here from Qinghai province in the extreme west of China, from the Jinan Locomotive Works in Shandong, from the Hangzhou Railroad Section Office in the East China province of Zhejiang. Another major theme in the press is the transformation of the schools. This week's Peking Review, for example, has as its lead article a study of a school now organized entirely within a factory and associated with a nearby people's commune and supervised by an army unit. This campaign to weed out so-called bourgeois teachers is combined with a major effort to move urban youth from the cities to country schools. These headlines concern the management of the campaign to send down Xiafang elementary schools to production brigades. Turning to rural villages, this article comes from Hainan Island in the extreme south, showing the diversity of this campaign. Its gist is that local units are to assume the cost of medical care and education in the future. Previously, these were shared by the state. A typical example of the reporting on rural villages is this one called The Red Sun Shines on Shan'an. Shan'an is the name of a production brigade in Hubei province. The importance of this article lies in stressing the brigade rather than the team, which is a smaller collective unit, or the commune, which is a larger collective unit. Stressing the brigade is the form of collective that will carry the burden in this new campaign. Many of these themes in the Chinese press were carried in last Sunday's Asahi Journal in Tokyo, which devoted a major section to current events in China. Here we see the lead article called China Waiting for the Ninth Congress. These articles suggest that the Cultural Revolution is just about consolidated and the time is ripe for Mao Zedong to launch his new organizational structure on another attempt at a great leap forward.
What did your press say about the cancellation of the American and Chinese talks that were scheduled to go in Warsaw, Chalmers?
Well, they explained it in terms of the defection of Liao Hoshu, the chargé d'affaires in The Hague, to the West, denounced the Americans for allegedly enticing him. There's a great deal of analysis, however, in the Japanese press, and a meeting was held in the Japanese Foreign Office of this. They presume that it was really internal events, that the Chinese probably in some disarray when they suggested these talks, and then they decided they didn't want them.
Well, this matter of disarray, Chen Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, was in Dutch with the Red Guards. Now he's back or is still in as foreign minister. One of his minor functionaries disaffects. Is this part of the package?
It certainly is part of the package. That is, there are only six people, the key top leaders in China, who have not come under some form of attack. His alliances, however, are secure.
Paul.
Chalmers, you referred to the East European rumor mill a while back, and I have to refer to it, too, because from it comes the information that the Congress is about to be held. It's going to be held very soon, and that it's going to be so staged as to take the limelight away from the planned international meeting in Moscow. Any confirmation of this in any press in the Far East?
No confirmation in the Chinese Communist press itself. The Japanese recently held a governmental conference in which they brought together their diplomats in the Far East to talk about Chinese affairs. They're very good on this subject. They believed that it was possible that it was imminent. It was possible that it was in May at the time of the Soviet International Conference, or that the other logical date would be October 1st later this year. Generally speaking, expert opinion tended toward later rather than earlier because the regime isn't quite ready, but it's obviously working hard to be ready.
Fred.
Many German and Swiss papers have reported that the West Germans have sort of made direct and indirect overtures towards Red China, not just economic, but possibly also political. This week, a story leaked out that had Foreign Minister Brandt gone to the Far East, he would have met Red Chinese representatives. Of course, he got the flu, he had to cancel the trip. Now, the Germans say that there was some response from the Red Chinese to these overtures. Do you pick anything up in the Chinese press or
No,
Japanese?
It's a typical affair. That is, West Germany is China's leading trading partner in Western Europe. West Germany does not recognize either Peking or Taipei. Obviously, the relations between the two are quite cordial. In order to keep them cordial, the Chinese never mention the name of West Germany. West German trade representatives in Hong Kong act as though they never knew or never heard of Mao Zedong.
Thank you, Chalmers. Now to our news roundup, as time will allow. First, the Soviet press and Paul Zinner.
Roger, in the Soviet Union, very important conference of student activists of the institutions of higher learning took place in the Ukraine, a union republic in which we have had alleged or reported difficulties of a nationalities type. The conference was addressed under this familiar portrait of Lenin by Pyotr Shelest, the first secretary of the Ukrainian party, and one of the hardliners, we are told, in the Politburo. He was generally laudatory of student accomplishments. He said the students studied hard and worked hard and were carrying the banner of communism forward. He made some comments on how well off they were in the Soviet Union as against students in the West, and some of these a bare repetition here. He said that 74% of the students in the Soviet Union are on scholarships. This is somewhat of a surprise because generally we were led to believe that 100% are on scholarships. He also said that it costs some 900 rubles to educate a student per year. And he said that, of course, in the United States, where he gave no percentages of students on scholarships, it costs between $1,200 and $2,500 a year to educate a student. And this makes it prohibitive for workers' sons and daughters to attend the university. However, toward the end of his speech, he also referred to a minority of students who succumb to the propaganda of the West, the imperialist propaganda, who are in college only to earn their diplomas so they can have a better life, who are loafers, who are romantics, and who obviously have to be dealt with in order to get them in line. Two very brief items from the Sunday supplement, Nedelya. One, a new column here on automobile inspection, or that is the hazards of automobile traffic. Two people were asked for their opinions about this picture, an automobile inspector who gave a lengthy technical explanation why this man should not cross against the light, and a psychiatrist who also started out giving a lengthy explanation and then finally said no reasonable and cultured person would cross anyhow, so why bother answering the question? And finally, an item on the training of stewardesses, Soviet stewardesses for international runs. The interesting thing is that the word is stewardess. It's the Russian word for it. And the stewardesses are comparable, I would say, to the stewardesses of other airlines on international runs.
Thank you, Paul. Next, the press of Japan with Chalmers Johnson.
Thank you, Roger. Japanese press has become very alarmed about the rising tide of fighting in Vietnam, above all about the possibility of a major Vietnamese offensive that could cause a rupture in the Paris talks. These fears were heightened last week when we had published on the front page of the People's Daily a statement by the number two man in Peking, Lin Biao, declaring China's everlasting support to the people of Vietnam until final victory. These were also added to by the broadcast of Ho Chi Minh's Tet message to the public in Japanese. Ho Chi Minh praised the victories of the past year, which he said had forced the United States to stop the bombing of the North, and he predicted the eventual total defeat of the United States. Most interesting, Ho Chi Minh paid special tribute to the communist figures who had done the fighting in the last Tet Offensive, that is, during the last Lunar New Year. This picture shows, in the Japanese press from Hanoi, shows Ho Chi Minh dancing with a group of children on the first day of the year of the rooster. Turning briefly to other news, Tokyo has been plagued with the worst smog in its history, so bad that it's made headlines in the national papers. Here's a picture outside of Kanda Railroad Station in Tokyo at mid-noon. Headlines say, Tokyo's first smog and fog warning report. Similarly, we have this story the next day, Smog Tokyo in a fix. The problem, of course, is too many automobiles, 11 million people, and improperly vented factories. It's producing a great demand for stronger air pollution control laws. Finally, the Japanese press last week was concerned about a new series of 15-yen postage stamps. Here we see one of them. It's a painting by the famous Japanese painter, the late Kobayashi Kokei, showing a woman washing the hair of another woman. The problem involved here for the Philistines, who used the Japanese press, was semi-nude postage stamps.
Thank you, Chalmers. Just a quick check with the rest of you, please, on the subject of Vietnam and the renewed offensive from the North. What does your press think is going to happen? Is it going to get rough over there again?
The Soviet press has been remarkably restrained, but it suggests that the patriots are defending themselves vigorously against American attacks, and it still suggests that they are going to win in the field.
In the German press, mainly AP-UP dispatches, but one editorial that says, if this offensive of the North were to succeed, this would be very damaging to the peace table in Paris.
The French press emphasized the the interview of Mr. Tran Bung Kim, who is the delegate or the head of the delegation at North Vietnam, and it says that the Saigon is afraid of the peace movement.
Well, the main view taken in the Japanese press is that a really spectacular push by the Vietnamese with serious American casualties would lead to tremendous pressure for restoration of the bombing. There is no question that the ceasing of bombing is aiding the South Vietnamese forces. Thus, they are worried about whether or not there is a negotiating situation.
There were contradictory reports last week, Roger, in two British conservative papers. The Economist thinks the U.S. on the whole held its position during last year and proved to the communists that they didn't gain politically all they'd hoped for in their earlier offensive. The Daily Telegraph, on the other hand, had an article from somebody who had been in Viet Cong-held territory and spoke warmly about the success of the Viet Cong efforts in the rural areas they control.
Thank you. Let's go on with the news roundup. Now the British press and Leslie Lipson.
It's a strange irony, among other things, Roger, that the meeting in London of the WEU, which the British had invited, was supposed to deal with the turmoil in the Middle East. because President de Gaulle, as we've already discussed, boycotted that meeting, and just at the very time when the Arab terrorists struck at the El Al airliner in the Zurich airport. All the British papers reacted to this with the same voice. They regarded it as an outrage to the international community. The Economist had it on the front cover, as you see in this way, the gunman of Zurich, and inside they said, and these are the Economist's words, nobody should regard the Arab terrorists now as a species of desert boy scout. They are, they said, a bloody menace to everyone. The Daily Telegraph had this leading article called Airport Terrorists. They viewed it with condemnation and disgust. They described it as a brazen and murderous violation of the international code. The Guardian here looked apprehensively towards the Israeli reprisals which they anticipated, and they seemed to imply that it would be justified in this case. They are hoping for a political settlement, and they emphasize that it must be one which gives Israel the guarantees for its inviolability, which thus far it lacks.
Thank you, Leslie. Next, the French press with Germain Thompson.
L'Express devotes the cover of this last number on February the 16th to the great choreographer Maurice Béjart and his ballet Baudelaire. The headline reads, Béjart leads the world of dance. The article inside the magazine is headed by the picture of Monsieur Béjart directing the dancer Paolo Bortoluzzi, and the writer says that Béjart believes that dancing is the art of today, that it is a meditation in which body and mind take place and man expresses his fate in dancing. The revolution of Béjart consists in presenting his ballet not to a handful of balletomans, but to mobs of people. That's why, for instance, he presented his ballet, The Ninth Symphony, in stadiums, in circuses, and in 79 performances, he played before 335,000 people. Romeo and Juliet, his other ballet, played before 298,000 people. It is such an important event in the world of art, and more than that, that Alfred Grosser, who is a great economist, devoted his last article not on the political economy, but to the ballet of Béjart called The Ninth Symphony. He said it was a plea from fraternity, not an easy fraternity, but a painful conquest through suffering and pity.
Thank you, Germain. Finally, the German press with Fred Breyer.
Just in case viewers believe that all German papers are responsible, democratic, and in the center, I thought there should be a reminder that there are a few papers on the far right and the far left, although they are, up to now at least, not very important. The best known of those is the Nationalzeitung. This is by no means the latest copy. Looks a bit like the papers in the Nazi period, and when you go to the content, it also is a bit reminiscent. For example, here there is World Jewry, and in other issues there's a conspiracy of the Jews of the world, always against someone. On January 10th, the Nationalzeitung had an article about the criminal state of Israel and the criminal state of Israel wanting to teach the Germans morals. So you get the tone of this paper. Well, Chancellor Kiesinger got it too, and they thought it was about time to sue the Nationalzeitung before the highest court of Germany, the constitutional court, that they should cease publication. Up to now, says Der Spiegel, which discusses the event, that the Nationalzeitung prints 150,000 copies and sells 90,000. What happens to the other 60,000, I do not know. The Spiegel is very critical and cynical about it and says that actually this will probably be like the ban of the NPD, that the Constitutional Court will probably not rule in favor of the government, that probably this was mainly some kind of gesture to convince others, particularly foreign countries, that the German government is watchful as far as things of that sort are concerned.
Just as a closing aside, Fred, does this paper support the NPD?
There have been, originally they did, and there were a whole series of difficulties between the NPD and the Nationalzeitung.
Thank you, Fred, and members of the panel, and thank you for watching. We'll be back with you next week when I hope you'll join us. Until then, Roger Boas saying goodnight.